Hi, Katrina. How are you?
Good.
Good, good. And we're having a very special day today because we're very on follow on from the launch of our book, Uprooted Medicine.
Great.
And we have both authors of this book here today, and we're going to have a discussion and kind of an informal chat about what it took to bring this into being. So the book is called Uprooted Medicine. And the subtitle is A Revealing History of Medicine That Restores Herbs to Patient-Led Care. So we're talking about a very positive message in there. It is so, so easy to doom scroll about how everything is bad and everything is terrible. And we have actually a very positive message about collaborative care. And this is something that I'm well experienced in because that's been the story of my practice over the last 50 years. 25 of which were in standard medical school, postgrad training, general practice in a working class area in North London. And having had the opportunity to study herbal medicine, I then went on to establish a practice in Galway, which incorporated both practices, and I would describe myself as a dual practitioner. In the course of this, I wrote a book about using herbs for osteoarthritis. And there was one sentence in that book, which, do you remember what the sentence was, Tim? I'm going to introduce Tim here now.
How are you doing?
Yeah.
How's it going? Yeah. There's probably, you were probably trying to justify the pedigree of herbal medicine.
Yeah.
Aside from the subject matter you're talking about, because people have they're warned against herbal medicine. It's not part of the teaching. It's generally perceived in a negative way.
Yeah.
In kind of mainstream publications. So when I was reading your book, that you asked me to edit back in
the original book.
I just felt you were getting dragged into that kind of more historical dimension or the pedigree dimension of herbal medicine, whereas your readers were kind of, they were looking to fix their osteoarthritis.
And my curious mind was getting in the way and putting too many words on the page.
You were trying to provide a fuller picture.
Framework, yeah.
A fuller framework for what you were...
We love that word framework, don't we?
Yes.
And what I'd done, I'd written the whole book and then I thought, why would people believe this? And that led me to the question of, why didn't they teach me about this in medical school? That was the fatal question, right? So if it was real medicine and it really worked, they would teach doctors how to use it. And I hadn't been taught it. Yet I went back to school and did a degree in herbal medicine in the Middlesex University. And then I tried it on my patients. Then I tried it on myself. It worked for me for recurring chest infections. My patients kept coming back and saying, I feel better. Their symptoms were improving. Their blood results were improving. They were using less drugs. But the main thing was, consistently, they kept coming back and saying, I felt better. And I thought, oh no, I have to listen to them. Which set me off on a trajectory of coming home and setting up a herbal medicine collaborative, integrated practice. Collaborative is the word that I use now. In the beginning, I used alternative, then integrative, and now I use the word collaborative, all of which will emerge from the book. Okay, I didn't introduce Tim properly. Tim's background is one as an academic with a PhD in geology, a genius of a mind for putting frameworks together, a vocabulary which is unparalleled, and we sat down and we thought, how do we get this wider framework and a history, reasons for it being omitted, where does that go? And I can't tell you guys. First of all, it took 10 years. This was one of the first drafts, and then changing this into this, thanks to Tribes Press, was the second part of the journey. So are we happy now, Tim?
I'm very happy, yeah.
Very pleased. The cover represents a lot of what's in the book. The cover is a doctor's bag, the Gladstone bag, which I certainly started off my, was a rite of passage for doctors to get this as their graduation present. But from it is growing lots of poppies and marigolds and other herbs. Because I see the two of them as working together. There's no line between them. Herbs have no borders. They've no professional rigidity. They work because they've always worked, because if one part of the book is how we co-evolved with herbs. They are our, they are suited to our metabolism, physiology, biochemistry, and it's the blend of tradition and science that has me totally intrigued. The other thing is the consistency at which it helps people in a clinical sense. So it was bringing together those academic skills in the context of clinically treating patients, and not from the point of view that herbal medicine is a panacea, not by any manner of means, but we know that after several podcasts, don't we, Katrina? We know that the herbal medicine, the patient has to do the work. The herbs are a helpful attribute with certain within certain limitations, okay? And they work for many people, not for all, and for degrees of illnesses and in degrees of collaboration. Okay, so having said that, we'll come back to the book. So what's in the book?
Well, just before you, before we go into the contents, I was warmed up. I was a general researcher, but I was warmed up to herbal medicine because I'm married to Lara Jonasdottir, a herbalist, who's your colleague. And so I was kind of generally in the frame of mind that, you know, herbal medicine did great things and was underappreciated. And as I started looking into the history, because I'm kind of naturally curious, I like to look into things in detail, you know, as you came to be aware. But I increasingly realized that it had gotten a very hard time in terms of portrayals, you know. And as you look more and more, you realize that this hard time is actually at least 500 years long, you know, if not more, you know. And this was a real eye-opener for me looking at this whole subject. I was seeing a whole kind of spectrum of outcomes that have been overlooked in medical history, patient history, and a whole side of medicine that was kind of I guess whitewashed is a good word over time, you know, but it didn't happen overnight either. It was kind of a gradual chipping away at you know, the pillars of herbal medicine and, you know, practitioners being targeted and all that. So I always felt the fact that you had spent your career in both disciplines was a very good foundation to tackle this subject and to lay out revised history of medicine or revealing history of medicine that, you know, tries to tell the story more evenly. And it was always a great background to join it with your clinical experience, because at the end of the day, even though it's a historic book, it's about, it feeds into patients making important decisions in the here and now, and that's where your main area of expertise is. So I think it was from the start, it was a nice blend of different perspectives and outlooks, and it came together well in the end.
So I think there's three groups of people who will kind of, by the end of reading this book, will go, oh, I didn't realise all that. One group will be the medical herbalists, and I think it's a massive affirmation, an affirmation of the shoulders that we stand on, who withstood, particularly in the last, since the Flexner Report in 1910, who have withstood all of the denigration and difficulties, over-regulation, hyper-vigilant inspection, looking for any flaw that can be used to dismiss herbal medicine. And they really
Guilty until proven innocent, as opposed to innocent until proven guilty. It's been a big factor in
In the whole story, So herbalists, I think, will find an affirmation. They'll also find a lot of challenges as to where herbal medicine goes now, because if we do actually have an active collaboration, which is supported by authoritative influences and allies, then there will be bigger expectation, regulation, as there is with all professionals, right? So many of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists in the UK has been there since 1868 and 64 has held the professional stance of herbal medicine and training within the confines of their financial resources to a large extent. So that's not a big jump in the British Isles. Every country has a different history. So for medical herbalists, there is affirmation and challenges. For doctors, there's a big, I didn't realise half of what we've actually, in addition to all the good things, we've actually overlooked a lot of things that were hidden under the carpet, if you like, and a lot of collaborations outside of medicine that maybe weren't wise, and that they are now, we now have a shortage of healthcare personnel that is putting massive strain on doctors. It was already a tough job to do. The absence of research in primary care. My job as a medical herbalist and doctor, there's no line between the two of them. In the kind of Western herbal medicine, or I call it classical herbal medicine, it's the same medical history, the same clinical examination, the same interpretation of physiology and biochemistry, increasingly just a massive evidence about the pharmaceutical actions of constituents at varying doses. As the complexity of network pharmacology and systems biology emerges, the line between pharmacology of plants and the pharmacology of drugs gets narrower and narrower. So there's lots of areas for collaboration. Now for patients, what's in this book for patients is strengthening their curiosity and looking and investing in a wider network than provided by a pill or product or massive surgical intervention, that there are other ways of maintaining and treating their health, and not to be shy of that, and to go for good, do mild to moderate interventions for mild to moderate problems and seek appropriate help from the most qualified health professional, but not necessarily limiting it to the current orthodox system, which is a very narrow bandwidth. The curiosity, I think, is the one thing we share.
Yeah, I think an important point that Dilys is making there translates as a stitch in time saves nine. I think the book will give people at the earlier stages of maybe when they're experiencing certain symptoms or whatever, as Dita says, mild to moderate end of the spectrum, it'll give them greater self-confidence to recognize, you know, in general what's going on with themselves, you know, how others may have experienced similar things, and most crucially that there are options available. You know, for example, we outline plenty of situations where herbal medicine has helped people with chronic disease that was otherwise being treated poorly, and I think there's growing numbers in the system that are experiencing that. So I think that's a timely aspect of the book, in that, you know, there's a real need out there for
we're in a pandemic of chronic diseases, including autoimmune diseases. Many of them are not being counted because there's no diagnosis available, and the number of diagnoses are growing by the day, you know, the additions to the autoimmune, and then they're seen by different specialists, they're counted in different numbers, so the overview is not there to say that this is causing as much ill health as maybe coronary artery disease or diabetes, which is where you attend one main specialty for the underlying problem. But there's lots of inconsistencies. I think my difficulty with whether this book was biased is that when you have an authority-based establishment profession backed up by all of the state's resources, all of the legal system, all of the insurance companies, that you have a professional system that invested It is very, you can't see it. It's like standing beside a whale. You can't see the whale. You just see black. You know, you can't see the whole thing. So this is how things are with the current medical system. All the good things that are in it they don't exclude other good things in other avenues, but it is so invested in every sphere of our lives that we can't imagine that there is something else which herbal medicine is universal, timeless. We co-evolved with it. It's traditional, it's orthodox, it's conservative, it's establishment, it's folklore. I mean, how many ways does it need to have a cosmology that's continuous with nature, you know, which is part of the natural world? It's a sustainable medicine. It's regenerative. What you take out, you put back in. There are so many good things that are as big as a whale, but we can't see them because we're only focusing on the one whale.
I think what can happen, and I think patients can maybe ignore situations for symptoms or conditions deteriorating over a long period. And, you know, then they go for like a diagnostic checkup and they might get bad news at that checkup. And then, you know, the medical system at that point tends to react very fast. You know, unfortunately, if it's something like a cancer diagnosis, things move very quickly at that point. So this book is really about rewinding the clock back, you know, in patient histories. They have confidence to act earlier and to embrace a wider health approach, because yeah. It can be, you know,
got to do with the terrain.
It can be intimidating when you get a firm diagnosis. At that point, you know, you can, the medicine that lies ahead of you is funded. It's all, you know, directed medicine.
Yeah. I think the herbal medicine is very good in acute situations. Like I get chest infections and I get, the minute I know it's coming, there's an uh-oh moment, I'm on the herbs, I'm in bed with my herbs and vitamin C and carrageen moss and all the rest of it. Haven't needed an antibiotic or an inhaler for the last, whatever, I call that acute medicine. I use high doses in there quickly. So there is a role in acute flare-ups of diverticulosis and acute flare-ups of all kinds of things. But that would be in collaboration with, you would also, if you're seeing a herbalist, you would also go and see your doctor. It's not a one or the other kind of thing. Up until 500 years ago, medicine, there was no herbal medicine. Sounds odd, doesn't it? Because all medicine was herbal medicine. You didn't differentiate. You went to the person who provided health care for your community and you said, these are the trouble I'm in, and you would go home with medicine that was generally made up of herbs, right? So that role still exists, right? We now have two possibilities with massive overlap between the two of them. Many, in fact, you know, there's a whole denialism in our current medical system that herbs don't work. And at the same time, 60% of our herbs are derived from the original empirical science of our ancestors using these herbs over long, long periods of time, doing the post-marketing surveillance, which is when we know about safety. When a drug is launched, that's when you find out over the next 5 years whether it's safe, or 20 years whether it's safe. So with herbal medicine, we've already done that. So the role of kind of overlapping between the two happened 500 years ago. So do you want to talk about that transition very briefly?
I mean, well, to be honest, I think this is one of the surprising things in the book, is that basically herbs disappeared in the darkness. There was minimal science done, you know, even though, you know, it has been claimed ever since that the medicine we have today is all science based. Basically, the herbal part of it was bundled off the scene before science of any kind entered the picture. And this, what I'm talking about here is kind of the 17th, 18th, early 19th century. You know, by the mid 19th century in mainstream medicine, there was very little herbs left in the in the tool bag. And also, almost, if you talk about the UK and Ireland, no local herbs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, there was some, you know, more exotic herbs from far-flung parts of the world, but local herbs, they had disappeared. And in the book we cover, you know, a former quite extensive, you know, history of the medical education and teaching and clinical practice in, you know, Ireland before the penal laws, which is basically, you know, the 15th century and before. And, you know, much of this knowledge was lost, you know. Some of it is being gradually refound in different manuscripts and here and there, but essentially a whole medical system was lost to Ireland and, you know, obviously many other countries around the world in the process. And this has been repeated time and time again, as there's a lot of references to medicine in North America, South America in the book. And, you know, these were all eroded over time and replaced by quite a small selection of drugs that were used for all sorts of conditions, you know, things like your aspirin and, you know.
But one of the things about our book is that we don't just limit it to medical tomes or resources. We also look at the ethnobotany and archaeology and other systems of science. You see, all of this has got to do with how do you define science. If you define science as observation over a period of time that things keep repeating itself, well, then that's the original basis of the traditional medicine. But that was discounted as anecdote and empirical science. So it depends on what you value. If you only value quantitative research.
Down through the ages, there's been a lot of kind of particular groups basically grabbing the microphone and saying, we are the scientists now.
Yeah.
Different times they had a lot of things backing them up, a lot of finance, a lot of money. So in effect, they were the scientists because they were funded to be the authorities, and their word was taken as gospel.
Yeah.
But I think if you go through the book and the many examples, there's often a 30 years or more cycle of, you know, something new is introduced, it goes worldwide, it's taken by millions of people, or some new procedure. And then, you know, in drips and drabs, the bad news starts coming in. It could take about 30 years for for a realization to happen that, oh, that's actually not good. You know, perhaps the harms have outweighed the benefits that were broadcast initially.
An example of that people may never have heard of is in the beginning of the 1900s, it was thought that the thymus, there was a quantification of the size of a normal thymus. If children had various symptoms or whatever, it was put down to having an enlarged thymus. And lots of thymus glands were erroneously and, you know, no benefit over the next 30 years it took for this to be established as being not a helpful practice. So it started off with great gusto, great claims made, and then, you know, problems arose, more problems arose. But it takes a long time for this ship to kind of change course. And it wasn't until 30 years later that it was actually totally discredited.
Yeah, I think.
And that's the kind of history that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's more about recognizing patterns, because a particular thing, like a product or a drug or whatever, that, you know, that can change, and people put up their hands, you know, the authorities put up their hands decades later and go, that was a bad thing. But what actually happens is that the same authorities are still in position, still doing the new products. Isn't and 30 it? Years later, you still have the hands up in the air. So I think an important aspect of the book is people question the system more based on, you know, numerous examples covered that, you know, the initial kind of hype around many things quite often doesn't materialize in reality. And I think this is a book about reality. You know, we cover primarily patient outcomes.
Yeah.
And this is widely neglected thing historically.
Yeah.
I think from what I've read, a lot of medical histories, they either focus on the personalities, you know, the great medical doctors, the researchers, or else they talk about, you know, institutions, or, you know, it's kind of, it's away from the patient, as it were. And this book aims to come back to, you know, what actually happened to patients. You know, did they get better? Did they get worse? Were lessons learned? Were the same people in authority left in authority after all was said and done? And, you know, the short answer to that is yes, they
and
were.
Did anybody apologize?
No. You know, it's all these things, you know, it's, you know, medical history is layer upon layer of, mm-hmm. of things. And, a constant theme throughout the book is matching authority with outcomes. You know, did those in charge at that particular time, you know, did what they say benefit patients, or did it not? You know?
Yeah, yeah. Including, did cigarettes really work to help anxiety, and was bottle feeding the best thing for babies and mothers?
Yeah, that's all.
Just to choose a couple of...
There's all sorts of different things covered. Yeah.
So I think one of the questions, I think that brings us up to what surprised you.
Yeah, I mean...
having all this 10 years of digging in here, what was your surprise, big surprises?
My surprise was that we outlined to basically turn into a book about medical history, which covers all different aspects of medical history. So you try to cover all the main subjects that you learn in school, Florence Nightingale, all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. you know, the typical stuff.
Jenner and the vaccinations, So
when I was researching the book, I was going through all these different things, expecting it to take, you know, to not be contentious, mm-hmm. because, you know, you just cover the things. But invariably there was a lot of contention at times about what you would consider to be just kind of standard mm-hmm. medical events, you know, throughout history. And that was the most surprising thing. If you really looked, you could find an awful lot of disagreement in medical history, and mm-hmm. That a lot of modern historians, or basically since the 20th century, they've ignored or overlooked. I don't know why, but there's far more contention out there than is portrayed, and that was the most surprising thing I came across.
And the current medical profession is extremely compliant with authorities.
Yeah, well, you can see in the last few years that the amount of pressures that are put on the medical profession to conform, and this goes all the way to, you know, retaining their jobs. What current practitioners in the crosshairs mightn't realise is that this is actually a very old phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, I can think of examples going back 200 years, you know, mm-hmm. Of the same thing, you know, a number of which we cover. So it's there, and it's not a new phenomenon.
And the last time I think the medical profession was this compliant was in applying Galen's principles in a very modified and extreme form for over 1,000 years, 800, 1,000 years. And I think that is another kind of sign that compliance does not always mean that the dominant practice is without its problems. And if you're not acknowledging them, then you're not in a position to fix them. And I think my biggest surprise was how sad I felt, actually, seeing these recurring events over and over and over again, amidst all the triumphs of how I would see the practice of medicine. And I think realizing how, teaching the medical students from the local medical college and seeing how enthusiastic and wide-eyed they are starting their practice, and how dispirited many come throughout their time is reflective of what's in this book, but that hasn't been recognized.
Yeah, I think one of the key areas that is covered in quite some detail, you know, possibly not directly, but it is covered, is polypharmacy. That's, you know, patients taking, you know, for example, five or more drugs would be a classic definition. But increasingly, we are seeing it now in modern medicine that patients are put on one drug and then another drug and another drug and possibly drugs to fix, you know, some of the drugs they're already on. And, you know, within a short space of time, it can spiral to a number of drugs. And this whole kind of aspect of medicine is really not evidence-based, because drugs are tested in isolation and they tend to be tested on, you know, somewhat younger populations. But I think a lot of patients now who are, say, 70 plus,
yeah,
and they're in the polypharmacy zone, in a lot of those patients, there's a lot of struggles there, I think.
Yeah.
And that's been a strong practical element of writing this book, is to kind of, it has a long history, and it helps when you know that history, because it helps you to make better decisions in the present.
And I think a benefit to patients would be in just helping them to question about family members. I mean, both Tim and I went through family experiences. My sister died of liver failure due to psychiatric medication over a long period of time, some of which she needed, but I don't think it was monitored to the extent or reduced in between episodes of difficulty in her life. And ironically then, she couldn't have a liver transplant because of her mental health problems. So it was sitting by that bedside was very, very tough. At the same time, I can say that I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the application of modern medicine, because it's very likely I would have absolutely in line for a major stroke when I was 36 weeks pregnant, without having the benefit of heparin and hospitalisation. So this isn't a flaky exercise in bashing at all.
One or the other. It's about discernment, really. It's about, you know, recognising the most appropriate medicine for whatever condition has been experienced. Obviously, there's a lot positive written about acute medicine in the book. Major medical advances. I think modern medicine does extremely well in that end of things. You know, this is not the area under contention in this book.
I'd extend that to chronic disease as well, like insulin, thyroid replacement, all of these things. Yeah.
But at the same time, there is, I don't know, would you describe it as a significant minority or a growing minority of patients who are you know, not doing well in the
outside the box. Yeah.
Outside the box.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this book is most relevant to them. I think, you know, as patients and as an advocate for patients, you know, perhaps you have an elderly parent, you have to have a lot of confidence in dealing with doctors, because they're busy, they have their own firm opinions. But at the same time, either as a patient or as a carer for a patient, you have an awful lot of expertise on the condition under consideration that the doctor who's only there for 10 minutes doesn't see. You know, if, you know, for example, which is something I experienced, my father was put on a drug and he went downhill very quickly, you know, far quicker than natural decline. And we contested it, but it was a difficult process to contest it. You know, it's not straightforward to do this, you know, and it requires, you know, kind of a certain firmness to do it, you know. But this happened on more than one occasion, and it was a very relevant side to the knowledge I was learning in writing the book, you know, that you can make a difference, you know, if you recognize, you know, let's say, for example, adverse drug reactions earlier, you can make a real difference, you know.
Yeah. As you can see, we could talk here for the next week, I should think, but we'll draw into the close. Now that it's out in the world, what's your reflection? Do you have any disappointments, or is there any projections that you would put for uprooted medicine moving forward?
We put our heart and soul into it over 10 years, so it's up to the readers, you know. I mean, I think it should be relevant to a number of readers, and you know, it's it was written to really kind of get under the surface or get under the hood of medicine. And I think, you know, from that scale, from that perspective, there's no disappointments. I think we've done a good job. It took a long time, a lot of hurdles to get over the line. But, yeah. You know, I think it should stand the test of time.
Yeah. I think I've spoken about, you know, the benefit to patients, herbalists, doctors, and just a wider viewpoint, like expecting product-based, single-constituent products to resolve the medical complaints that reflect psychosocial, emotional, have multi-layered, immune neurotransmitters, disease processes, to expect one system with such a narrow approach to address all of these problems is unrealistic. Only we haven't. The vast majority of people haven't realized that it's too big an ask. And your doctor is not going to know about herbal medicine because they haven't been trained in it. So expecting a doctor to know about herbal medicine is like expecting a computer shop to sell plant seeds, okay? So it's about kind of for people to find their own resources within a wider framework. I'm speaking from the point of view of herbal medicine. But the one I haven't said is I hope this would have a policy impact in, I'm not sure what the correct term is, emerging nations or nations which are emerging post-colonialism. This book takes into a lot of factors of world geopolitics and social aspects and post-colonialism, patriarchy, class, racism. They are all reflected in this book. It covers a wide variety, diversity of sources. But one of the things that I would like to see is that for emerging economies, that they would read this history and invest proportionately in their own indigenous medicines. I would hope that social policy in the industrialized nations would actually make space in public policy and public funding of our taxes in actually resourcing herbal medicine for us. We have our own hedgerows. I'll be taking Katrina out now as soon as the new year comes in and the growth comes up, and you can accompany us on all of the things that are in the hedgerows. The other message I would say about this book is that it's about abundance. Herbal medicine is abundant and generous. And in a world that seems obsessed with austerity and things being scarce, I would say that the world of herbal medicine is an abundant and generous herb and cooperative. The herbs cooperate with our own physiology in a healing way. And healing was one word they rarely use in the medical scenario. Mm. Yeah. So for all the people who have felt outside the box, for all those in the box whose medicines might be reduced or, you know, for a lot of problems that aren't fatal or seriously threatening, the medicines can be very strong compared to the mismatch in the terrain. So they're another whole group of people that I think would benefit. And Katrina is going... and I wouldn't blame you. We did, yeah.
Just explain to the listener where the book can be bought.
Oh, yes.
How you can get it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's available through joinedupmedicine.com.
And if they wanted to go to the bookshops?
It'll be soon available in the bookshops. It's in some local bookshops as we speak. This is just 10 days off the press.
Yeah.
So we will be organizing further distribution. But in the meantime, log on to joinedupmedicine.com, all one word.
Thank you so much. And also, thank you, Tim, for coming in to chat with us this morning.
Thanks, Kat.
Yep. We really appreciate it. again, you could always come back to this and do another chat if you wanted to in the future. And we'll put it out there to the listener and see what we can do for that. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thanks, Katrina.
We really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for joining us on the Herb Podcast, Herb Doctor Podcast today. You can find us on all social media platforms. We'd love your feedback and we'd love to hear your comments. So get in touch through there and we will talk with you very soon. Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.